From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. One way or another, politics is an expression of moral values. And for many people, morals are rooted in religion. The role that religion should play in public life has been the subject of a lot of talk lately, and the Reverend Jim Wallace has been involved in much of the conversation. Reverend Wallace is the founder of the Christian ministry group Sojourners and author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. He's in Durham this week for a forum at Duke Chapel that examines the question of religion and politics and joins me now on The State of Things. Jim Wallace, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Glad to be here.
First, let me ask you if you agree with our premise that essentially all politics are based on moral conviction or moral values.
Oh, I do. In fact, I think a conversation about values ought to be the future of American politics. That's the right discussion to have.
You have said that religion at its best is not ideologically predictable. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, religion doesn't have a monopoly on morality. We need to say that. But religion often shapes the moral compass of a candidate, a politician, or an electorate. And I think religion at its best is not a wedge to divide us, but bridges that bring us together on the big issues. So I like it when religion isn't so ideologically predictable or politically partisan, but can hold both sides accountable. King never endorsed a candidate, but he made them endorse his agenda. And so I think we're the ones who ought to be shaping social movements with spiritual foundations around the big issues. Like for King, it was civil rights. I would say now the battle to overcome poverty should be a bipartisan agenda and a nonpartisan cause. And I think people of faith can help hold both sides accountable to those kind of moral agendas.
But whether you call it religious conviction or moral conviction, it is it is a conviction, and it is something that people hold to dearly, and particularly if they believe this is inspired conviction. And so how do you bridge that? Clearly, people have very different moral and religious ideas about poverty, about whose responsibility it is to bring themselves out of poverty or to bring our brothers and sisters out of poverty.
Yeah, and referring back to Dr. King, I think he had a way of finding common ground by moving to higher ground. You mentioned poverty. The poor are stuck in our debate about poverty. They aren't just trapped in poverty. They're stuck in the liberal conservative debate. And I think we have to kind of move beyond that and talk about both personal and social responsibility, talk about the culture issues that the conservative side likes to discuss about out-of-wedlock birth and family breakdown and all that, which I think are important issues, as well as investments in childcare, education, healthcare, housing, which the liberal side likes to talk about. So I'd like to, you know, have a kind of grand alliance where liberals begin focusing on strengthening marriage and family and the whole out-of-wedlock birth crisis, and conservatives talk about strategic investments in healthcare, housing, education, and so on. That would be a breakthrough in Washington. But I think around the country, people are wanting results and outcomes. Washington, D.C., as you know, Frank, you've been here before, both sides take an issue, and they first want to make us afraid of it, then blame the other side for it, and they never get back around the solution. So it's a politics of blame and a politics of fear. The country's hungry for a politics of solutions and a politics of hope.
Well, you talked about the idea that you'd like to see the left, liberals, embrace the idea of personal responsibility at some level when the idea of family values is raised. Do you see any evidence? This conversation has been going on, you know, in one way or another for a couple of years now. Are things changing?
They're changing in the country, and that's the good news. Washington will be the last to change. You know, I could talk about changing the wind. We have to change the wind and not just elect one wet-fingered politician after another with his finger up in the wind. When the wind changes, it's amazing how fast politicians with their fingers in the wind, how quickly they change course. That's why I believe social movements change politics. Lyndon Johnson wasn't a civil rights leader until Martin King and Rosa Parks made him one. So that's what I care about. Around the country, I do think, I mean, I'm talking to very diverse groups. They're large crowds, and they're in red places and blue places, and half are under 30. And they're weary of our partisan Every issue has only two sides, left, right. They're weary of that. They want solutions. They want outcomes.
What do you make of this a document released earlier this week of some 55 House Democrats who are Catholic released a statement, a statement of principles based on Catholic social teaching. And there it is in this document, right under the seal of the U.S. House of Representatives, talking about Catholic social teaching.
Exactly. Well, I love it because I'm an evangelical Christian, but I love Catholic social teaching from the Protestant side. I'm a convert to Catholic social teaching. Catholic social teaching is often, they often say, the best-kept secret in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. But we all ought to take a look at it. It's very, very... and again, it's a kind of even-handed thing I'm talking about. It's not partisan left or right, but it's focusing on, you know, solidarity with the poor and these wonderful ideas that I think make sense. Solve a problem at the local level as much as possible, but you need the politics of scale. You can't solve health care just at the local level. And so these are lawmakers, and they're Catholic, and they're trying to embrace Catholic social teaching in its wholeness. They're speaking against single-issue voting, where there was a handful of bishops, as you remember, last election, who said there's only one issue on which Catholics are allowed to vote, that being the abortion question, which I think is an important issue. But that really runs against the whole notion of Catholic social teaching, which talks about a consistent ethic of life wherever life is threatened, HIV, AIDS, poverty, nuclear weapons, and abortion, that these things have to be taken as a whole and not broken out in such a partisan and divisive way.
But clearly there are divisions, even in this statement by these House Catholics. They acknowledge that they are at odds with the doctrine in their own church. They want to reduce unwanted pregnancies. They want to bring down dramatically the number of abortions. Catholic teaching says abortion is prohibited. So clearly there are tensions within each faith community about what their social teaching is.
You're right. And then we have this issue, how to deal with an issue like this in the public square when you've got people who are religious and some are not. My own feeling about this, Frank, is that the sacredness of life is such an important issue. It ought not to be used as a divisive political and symbolic issue football, if you will, during election time, and then dropped between elections. I don't like the kind of pro-life view that wants to protect unborn lives, unborn children, but seems to not be concerned about them after they're born. If you want to be protected by the right wing and you're a child, you want to stay unborn as long as possible, because after that, they cut you loose. Health care, child care, all the rest is gone. So I want a consistent ethic here. And so I think most Americans think the abortion rate is far too high. We have too many unwanted pregnancies in this country, and we should work together, pro-life and pro-choice, work together on teenage pregnancy, adoption reform. Supporting low-income women always reduces the abortion rate. So I want Democrats to take this seriously as an issue. I want Republicans to stop just posturing during election years and try and do something about the abortion rate, which hasn't changed. In fact, it's getting worse in the last 5 years.
It seems to me that every conversation on the subject drifts between two questions. One is how is it that right-wing evangelicals have come to define Christian values? And the other one is, how can liberal politicians find a narrative with a ring of religious authority that seems to resonate with voters? So I'd like to take these one at a time with you and ask first if you think the Christian right is in any way losing traction. Are progressive Christians finding a voice?
The religious right is losing control over this environmental debate a couple of weeks ago. Now, you know, evangelical Christians, 89 of them, heads of Christian colleges, signed this evangelical, climate initiative. And the religious right, Dobson and Colson and the rest, tried to stop it, and they failed. And so I was at Gordon College just last week, and the president there signed this thing. He said, "I'm tired of a handful of old white guys controlling this conversation," he said. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a younger white guy. and so a whole new generation is saying, no, I was in Britain last week, and they're amazed to hear an American who didn't think God was an American or only a Republican who cared only about abortion and gay marriage. But, a lot of evangelicals, I'm an evangelical, and they're applying faith to sex trafficking and Darfur and the Sudan and global poverty and the environment. These are now going to be evangelical issues. So I think that debate is changing dramatically, and the right's losing control.
How about liberal politicians? Have they figured out how to get God on, their side?
Well, you know, when I got some calls after the election, I did get some calls from Democrats right away. Hey, we're in trouble.
Yeah, you're a busy guy.
Yeah.
Right?
I said, you know, if you just want me to give you a few Bible verses and a few hymns and teach you how to clap at the right time in a black church, you know, that's you haven't got the right guy here. But if we want to talk about content and vision and how to find a moral vocabulary, like when we talk about a budget, let's talk about how a budget is a moral document, reflecting the priorities of a family, a church, a city, a nation, or a, you know, and they have begun to speak that way. And plus, the worst thing to be is inauthentic. You don't want to get religion when it isn't authentic. Howard Dean learned that. You know, Job was his favorite New Testament book. The problem was it's in the Old Testament. And Howard and I, you know, I've talked to him about that since, and I said, you know, I don't think you should be the theologian here for the Democratic Party. But Barack Obama, you know, speaks authentically out of a black church context in Southside Chicago. And, you know, Cain just ran for governor in Virginia, and his Roman Catholic faith was a real factor in what made him attractive to Virginia voters. But he didn't just get religion for the election. So I think when Democrats are people of faith, they should be unapologetic and speak out of their faith. And, you know, we have to have a moral conversation about politics, not a religious debate. Nobody wants to be proof texting the meaning of Leviticus on the floor of the Senate. But you have a moral discourse, what's best for the common good. And those of us who do come to that from a place of faith shouldn't be afraid of speaking that language.
Jim, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Jim Wallace is the founder of the Christian ministry group Sojourners and the author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking this hour about efforts by Democrats to build some religious beams into their platform. Since the 2004 election, they've made an all-out effort to match the success Republicans have enjoyed through their alliance with the Christian right. But how to do it? Liberals are known to be a little queasy about mixing church and state. Well, this week, a group of 55 Roman Catholic Democratic representatives issued a statement on the role their faith plays in their public lives. Have the Democrats found religion? David Price is a Democratic congressman from North Carolina's 4th District, which includes portions of the Triangle. Congressman Price, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And William Barber is president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP and pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
William Barber, let me start with you. You heard Jim Wallace earlier in the program invoke the name of Martin Luther King and cite the civil rights movement as an example of the alliance of faith and politics. Has that connection been lost? It has, hasn't it? And why was that connection lost?
Well, I think in some ways it may have you know, lost some of its momentum and not been pushed. You know, there was an outright attempt after the death of Martin Luther King to remove certain things as moral concerns and just make them issues, you know, that you could choose or not choose. You remember Lyndon Baines Johnson on the floor of the Congress, and he talked about civil rights being a moral issue. And there was efforts by certain persons to remove that. But I think we're seeing a recapturing of that. That's not Democrat, that's not Republican, but it's about real issues that I believe are absolute when you talk about faith, and that's truth, compassion, concern for the poor, justice and mercy, those kinds of
things. Well, where is that coming from? If you say it's not coming from the top down, then it's coming from the...
Well, a lot of it's coming from the bottom up, and people are beginning, like Jim Wallace, to hear, stop just listening to truth, to have truth, but listen to the whole truth of the gospel. And I see it being challenged in a lot of areas, particularly among clergy. We see it happening with the NAACP. You know, the NAACP had a moral stance on issues before the laws changed. And they kept that moral stance, that value stance, before the laws changed. And for real change to happen in this nation, that's what has to happen.
Congressman Price, in addition to your other duties on the Hill, you are the co-chair of the House Democratic Caucus Faith Working Group. Tell us a little bit about that. What do you do?
This is a group of members, an expanding group of members, who have had conversations over the last year about the relation of faith and politics. For many of us, this isn't a new conversation. But it is a conversation that we undertake with, I think, a new urgency, because we see the religious banner being co-opted by people whose religion and politics we think falls short of the kind of public witness we ought to make. And so we're partly talking about where we're coming from in terms of our own histories, our own convictions, the kind of values we bring to politics, and we're also debating some of the issues. It's not always the simplest of matters to say what our faith implies for a given issue, or what the ground rules are in bringing faith into politics.
Is there concern when you have those conversations, a concern expressed that your constituency, a liberal constituency, might recoil if you begin to use liturgical religious language as part of your moral conviction and public life?
I really do not feel that concern in North Carolina. I think, on the contrary, there's a widespread understanding that most of us, our political involvement is grounded in our deepest convictions and in our faith traditions. I know some people mistakenly believe that the separation of church and state, or the establishment clause of the Constitution, requires some kind of separation of faith and politics, but I don't know how anyone who has lived in this region, and particularly lived through the civil rights movement, can believe that. I was able to go with the congressional delegation out to Rosa Parks' funeral in Detroit, and I looked around at one point at the members of Congress who had gone on that trip, and I knew without asking why members of my generation were disproportionately represented. Because we were liberated, black or white. We were liberated by that movement, and our religion was changed. Our politics were changed. We as a country owe a great deal to this, and for many people, including myself, our political activism dates from that experience.
Faith certainly may have been a foundation of political activism in the 1960s, but one of the things that did not happen in the 1960s was a certain Roman Catholic candidate for president did not link his Catholicism with his public life. John Kennedy went to great lengths to distance himself and say, look, I don't tell the bishops what to do. They will not tell me what to do. And as I said, this week in Congress, a group of 55 Catholic representatives did something that was quite different. They issued a statement that connected their public life with their Christian and Catholic moral teaching. And joining us on the phone now from California is Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. Representative Eshoo is one of the signers of that statement of principles. And Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Tell us why you signed this.
Well, I think as Congressman Price has so eloquently stated, we are individuals that are based in our faith. Our faith instructs us. And this is, as David said earlier, a conversation that members have had quietly for quite some time. And what we are unified by are the principles of our faith, and we see that being lived out in what we do, just as people of faith around the country and around the world do. We are instructed by the moral teachings of our faith, and we thought that it was important to express that. We're committed to making the real basic principles that are at the heart of Catholic social teaching intertwined with what we do. It's not an easy thing to do for anyone in the world today. But nonetheless, we thought that this was very important. We felt that it was very important for us to make this statement.
Well, you talked about principles, and that's one thing. Doctrine is quite another, particularly in the Roman Catholic Church. What's interesting about this document is that you have pro-choice and anti-abortion Democrats both signing this. The document itself talks about reducing the number of abortions and unwanted pregnancies, but not eliminating. This puts it in conflict with Catholic doctrine. What do you make of the fact that anti-abortion Democrats have signed on to this particular document?
Well, we are really bound together by so many issues, by helping the poor and the disadvantaged, by protecting those that are the most vulnerable amongst us, We want to open up the blessings and the promise of our country. And these are very, very serious issues. And as Christians, as Catholics, indeed people of all faith backgrounds, I think really adhere to what we know as the Beatitudes. And so our faith is not poised on the head of a pin. It's very broad. It's very deep. And you know, I mean, for every single one of us, this is what we were taught. Many of us are products of
I don't want to get too far from the abortion issue itself, because this is a very strong point, particularly in the church. And I wonder if this signals the beginning of some kind of dialogue on a topic where dialogue really wasn't possible before. It was a black and white issue. If you believe that abortion is
sin. Agree with you. I think that there needs to be far more dialogue about it. There's not one of us that celebrates abortion. Anytime an abortion takes place, it spells a failure. And so we are committed to reducing them and to shape public policies that will move us in a direction where they don't have to take place. But Catholicism is far broader than the issue of abortion.
All right, Congresswoman Eshoo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anna Eshoo is a Democratic congresswoman from California's 14th District, one of the 55 signers of a Catholic Statement of Principles. We're talking today about politics and religion, particularly in the Democratic Party. Can liberals find the voice of God and speak with it in a clear voice in a way that has helped the Republican Party with its alliance with the Christian right? And my guest this hour, Congressman David Price, Democratic congressman from North Carolina's 4th District, and William Barber, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, also pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. You know, on this question of the document that the Catholic Congress people signed, Congressman Price, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne wrote that with any luck it could provoke two debates, one outside the Catholic Church, one inside. Is that what you're hoping for in this? And not just strictly among Catholics, but the abortion debate nationally has been one that I suspect you could apply that hope to.
I think Anna Eshoo just expressed very well the common ground that many, many people have come to on the abortion question. I have a consistent so-called pro-choice position, but at the same time, I'm not about to celebrate abortion. I know that it's often a tragic choice, and that we need to, as President Clinton formulated it, we need to make abortions available under the law, but they should be rare, and we should all see the challenge in that. So, yes, it's partly a matter of finding some common ground in a debate that is so polarized, but it's also a matter, I think, it raises the broader issue of how our faith relates to our politics. And it this urges us to get on with the business of translating what we most care about and most believe in into our public life, and what's more, communicating about that with the people who we serve.
William Barber, are you finding that there are efforts nationally and efforts here in the state of North Carolina to build these kind of coalitions, perhaps interfaith dialogues that work apart from the political process to move the process in the way that Jim Wallace suggested happened and we know happened in the civil rights movement?
Oh, sure. And it's always been, I think when you asked me the question, I'm going, it may have waned. This discussion has consistently gone on. It has a lot to depend on how the media reports it, as you know. Certainly that is one of the roles of the NAACP. I'm not here to discuss the Democrat or Republican side of it, but the public policy side of it. But I think that one of the dangers is what we're seeing right here today with this conversation. I don't even engage the right-left conversation. I think the issue is these values of truth, justice, and compassion. I think that's a media, political creation, this whole left, right wing. You know, let's talk about truth and justice, a plane needs two wings to fly. You know, we want to talk about abortion. Let's talk about What do we abort when kids don't get health care once they get here? What do we abort when we have poverty at the levels that we have and in communities that are disenfranchised? What do we abort when we go backwards into resegregation and have a high poverty, segregated schools, and forget that the decision the Supreme Court made on Brown versus Board of Education was a values decision, a moral decision, not just a legal decision? They raised the question, how can you have a constitution that says it's about the establishment of justice and have apartheid in your educational system among your most vulnerable people, which are your children? That's a faith discussion. That's what we've got to have.
Let's go to the phones. Hugh is on the line from Durham. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to make the point that studies show that there are 30 million people in the United States who do not attend church on Sunday. And I think that this emphasis on faith, faith, faith runs the risk, especially for the Democratic Party, of turning people off and feeling like they're being ignored in terms of their source for values.
All right, Hugh. Thanks very much. Congressman Price?
I fervently hope that doesn't happen and don't think it should happen. One of the happy experiences of the civil rights movement, just to go back to that, was that we could work together on an interfaith basis and find a common basis for action with people who didn't come to politics with a traditional faith perspective. Of course we can work together. In a pluralistic democracy, we have to work together if we're going to achieve anything. But I think that's a positive value, not a concession we reluctantly make.
Well, but I think the at the root of Hugh's question is, if we use theological language, if you use scripture as part of the speech, there are those who would feel left out of the conversation.
Well, we do need to be sensitive to that and inclusive in the kinds of references that we make. But I have found that in speaking with audiences that are decidedly mixed in religious terms, that there's no offense in drawing in elements from religious traditions to illustrate, to give force to what we're saying. But he certainly has a point. There is an inclusiveness here that we have to always strive for.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I hear Jim Wallace saying, Congressman Price, and our host today, and I'm saying, is that it's not about trying to create a democracy that's exclusive, but it's trying to say to people of faith convictions, you can enter the fray, and that this so-called right wing is not the only conversation. In fact, it is half of the truths of the values that grow out of the scriptures. That's the issue. Don't exclude me as a person who faith that believes health care and poverty are faith issues, are value issues.
What about the
Let me just interject here. I had a conversation recently, a very public conversation on NPR with a very conservative Christian spokesman who's a colleague in Congress. And he was saying to me, you're wanting to water things down when you talk about inclusiveness, when you talk about this common ground quest. And I said, think about that. We seek common ground in the common terminology, common values of American democracy, liberty and justice for all, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For goodness sakes, are those watered down values? Of course they have religious roots and we bring religious conviction to them, but I don't think we have any absence of solid values to bring to the political arena, and those are values which are shared across religious lines and secular lines.
We keep talking about these common values, and we also talk about, you heard Jim Wallace talk about a country being weary of these partisan conflicts, wanting results, wanting outcomes. So why is it so easy to drive these wedges and to make these issues as divisive as they've become?
Because part of what we do, even in the way we talk about it in the media, we have this conservative, liberal discussion, which is not even Christian. Jesus didn't go around talking about conservative and liberal. He talked about righteousness and justice, not conservative and liberal. And so some of my conservative friends, part of the problem is, I love them, but when we talk, they don't want to read all the Bible. That's part of the problem that we have. You know, we don't want to deal with the fullness of the faith text that inform us.
Yeah, but I guess I can hear someone saying, no, the problem is that because Scripture is subject to very, very subjective interpretation, we're bound to have these kind of arguments. I read the whole thing, and I read it differently than you do.
Well, you could say that, but you could also say that there's not a whole lot of debate that if you look at Scripture, you're supposed to care for the poor and have compassion. There's not a lot of debate about that in America in our founding documents. I mean, some years ago, some people talked about we needed a new contract in America. We need a new contract. We got an old contract to find life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. This is for the establishment of justice. That's what we need to be pulling out of. We don't have to create all these nuances. We just need to pull out of the depth of what is already present. That's the genius of Martin Luther King. He made us be true to what we said on paper. Mm.
There is a religious counsel of humility, though, as well, and that's not something imposed on us by secular societies, something that comes from the depths of our faith. I think it's hard to match Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural in this regard. I mean, there is moral conviction there, an unyielding moral conviction. We are going to finish the work that we are in, he says. And he has a strong condemnation of slavery in moral terms. But then at the end, he says, in the end, judgment belongs to God alone. He acknowledges that both sides read the same Bible and pray to the same God. I mean, there is a sense there that our will is not God's will, and that our causes have to be subjected to God's judgment. That, I think, is a perspective that comes from within our religious faith itself.
We are talking about political judgment, God's judgment, and we want to hear your judgment as well. As our conversation continues, we're joined by Congressman David Price, who represents the 4th District of North Carolina, Reverend William Barber, the president of the North Carolina NAACP and pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, and your phone calls at 877-962-9862 as the state of things continues. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about faith and politics, particularly faith and the Democratic Party. With us in the studio are the Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP and pastor at Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, and Congressman David Price, a Democrat who represents the 4th District of North Carolina and who co-chairs the House Democratic Caucus Faith Working Group. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Let's go right to the phones. And right now, Bush is on the line from Wilson. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon. I was listening to the conversation, and I heard that the political convictions are faith-based. And my question is regarding abortion. And we see, as a secular democracy in this country, there are people from different religions and different faiths. And abortion, some of them look at it as a medical issue, as their personal issue. And if legislators are basing their decisions on faith, how they would address the society in general, which people may have different faiths.
All right. Thank you, Bush.
Well, one of the things that I can say is that, for instance, as a evangelical Christian myself, I'm anti-abortion in the sense that and it's not about being pro-life, pro-choice, it's about being about life with my faith convictions. But I also believe that that means then if somebody is going to bring a baby here, I got to be willing to take that baby in, not just tell them to have it. But I'm also anti the death penalty. I'm also anti once we get kids here, then we kill their dreams and abort their dreams by putting them in poor schools. And those are moral issues as well. So I think that we have to broaden this discussion. And I would want to say that it's not just the civil rights movement. We need to go back and look at the social gospel movement of Rawson Rauschenbusch, the turn of the century, how the abolitionists were people of faith. I mean, you know, this is a broad discussion.
David Price, I want to know how you have this discussion, though. If it's a matter of faith, if you believe that God has said, for instance, if we stay with abortion for a moment, it is a sin. This is off the table. How do we even discuss it? How does this become an item for negotiation?
This is the sort of issue we really need to wrestle with, not just the substance of the issue, but also how we handle it in the public arena. And I think the debate takes place on a couple of levels. In the first place, within religious communities, there does need to be a discussion of this and other issues. All religious convictions and all religious values don't necessarily point in the direction of a hardline position that abortion should be criminalized. There are faith-based arguments that have to do with human liberty and other values that might very well qualify that position, even if you're arguing only within the faith community. And then when you take the matter into the public square, there's the additional issue which the caller raises, and that is, how do you find common ground? And what should a person of faith do when it turns out the arguments for a given policy are pretty much limited to a given religious perspective. Does then one argue that this should become the law of the land? That's not an easy question.
And believing that something is a sin, that it comes short of an ideal, does that mean you don't talk about forgiveness and all kinds of issues? Let me give you a quick example. I had a friend of mine who was a pastor, and a young girl came to him and wanted an abortion. He talked and talked against having an abortion. They still decided to have the abortion. He said, okay, I'll go with you to the abortion clinic. They said, what? He said, sure, I'll go with you. I don't agree with you, but I'll go with you, go through the abortion, and still be there when you come out to show you that you're not pushed aside. See, that's what I mean. We've got to have a depth discussion, not just a political discussion, but a discussion with some serious depth.
Let's go out to Durham. Kevin is on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Hi.
You have a question for us?
Well, I was calling because of this, you know, I'm an atheist. And so often when you're having political discussions, as soon as faith comes up, people who are secular or non-religious shut down the conversation. And I actually have a problem with that. You may have arrived at your beliefs through faith, and I may have arrived at mine with logic. But as soon as the religion comes up, it is such a gate for people that it makes things challenging.
All right. Well, Kevin, let me ask you this. I want to get a response to that. But if you heard what William Barber just said about the possibility of people of faith looking at both sides of their faith, a conviction that perhaps something is wrong, but an understanding that forgiveness is also part, and they moved in that direction, is that a little more a conciliatory a point of view?
And I think absolutely. Something very holistic. For instance, if you have an anti-abortion stance, you can't have an anti-welfare stance.
That's right.
And I think so often a lot of these things become so black and white that they're considered in isolation. I think the idea of forgiveness in conjunction with discussing the right and wrong of issues is absolutely credible. You know, forgiveness is not a religious concept alone, but so often it's not part of what's discussed in these religious issues.
Congressman, thank you very much for your call, Kevin. Congressman Price, is there any appetite across the aisle in Congress, and I'm talking about with the Democrats and Republicans, both, to have this kind of discussion, to say, let's have the discussion about abortion in the broad context of poverty or of eliminating the causes? Do you find any appetite? Are there any other members who on the other side of the aisle who want to engage in the dialogue that way and begin a conversation at the national level just like that?
Yes, I think there are, and I've had a number of interactions with such members through the Faith and Politics Institute and other organizations within the Congress. The point that Jim Wallace made this morning, and Reverend Barber too, though, I think is absolutely right. We don't look to politicians, or shouldn't look to politicians, to be the initiators of the kind of conversations and soul searching that we're talking about. One would hope that they would be people of conviction and faith themselves who would make a positive contribution. But what we're talking about here is a real wellspring of conviction that we do need to have this national conversation. And it's not just conversation. It's a matter of figuring out what we stand for as a people and how we're going to make our public life reflect that.
William Barber?
You know, it shouldn't take the wind of Katrina, as ugly as it was, to make us talk about poverty and about death. If we're going to have a conversation about abortion, let's change from having a conversation about abortion. Let's have a conversation about the death of our times. Talk about the death of dreams, the death of opportunity. Yes, the death of children before they get here, and war. Let's talk about death in war and misguided and being misled and the ugliness of war as a sin, as a failure from meeting the ideal of God. Let's have serious reflection about that.
Is there an appetite in the faith community? Do you participate in conversations among conservative clergy to have that kind of a dialogue among church members?
Yeah, and again, I won't answer conservative because I don't even pay into that. I can talk with Christians of all and Muslims and other people of all faith, and we have these conversations. In our church, we have people that are conservative on certain personal moral issues, but also liberal on so-called associates. So we don't get into the liberal conservative. We try to fashion and pull from the depths of our faith. And it's kind of like when Congressman talked about Abraham Lincoln. There's another story about Frederick Douglass was getting very wearied about the movement, and he had his hands in his head, was ready to quit. And Harriet Tubman asked him, "Is God dead?" And when Frederick heard that question, it shocked his soul, and he went back to pushing Lincoln to do what he ought to do. That's how faith pushes you.
It sure does. And I do think it's a constant challenge for faith communities as well as for political leaders. You know, there's a saying that's often heard that our faith is supposed to comfort the afflicted, but if it's doing its job, it's also going to afflict the comfortable. And afflicting the comfortable is not the easiest thing, even for a devout congregation. It's too easy to pick and choose, to pick only those issues that we're comfortable with or that don't divide us. That's not what our faith demands.
Let's go out to Bob and Carrie. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Hi. During the conversation here, I've noticed a number of things. First of all, people of conviction versus people with no conviction, meaning that if you don't have conviction by way of faith, that you just don't have any convictions, which isn't true. People of faith itself, does that mean that people that don't go to church have no faith in anything? And the word God and has been brought up a number of times, which is really a hot item in a lot of people's minds, because you're leaving off the total Native American community by not saying a common term like creator. Why can't both sides come up with better language that covers more common ground instead of saying God all the time politically and in speeches and talks and other things? Why can't people agree to say something like the Creator, which covers a lot more common ground?
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Well, I happen to be part Tuscaroan, so, you know, I don't have a problem talking about something, the Spirit, Holy Spirit, and the value ethics that grow out of the Spirit. But I think that certainly I haven't said that people don't have convictions. I believe folk have convictions, period. But, you know, and again, the conversation, people that don't go to church, Jesus didn't always go to church. In fact, sometimes he whooped folk out of the so-called temple for not being about justice. I mean, but again, the faith discussion is bigger than a discussion about where you go at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Absolutely, and I'm glad this caller said what he did, because it maybe gives us a chance to underscore yet again that we're not castigating people who come from different faith traditions or who don't claim a faith tradition at all. We understand that our fellow citizens, so many of them, are people of conviction. And so what we're urging, I think, in the deepest sense, is those convictions be brought to the public arena. And it's incumbent on all of us to bring some common tolerance and understanding to that, and to understand not everyone's going to talk about it in exactly the same way.
There are a lot of life and death issues that are part of the public debate. The death penalty is a life and death issue. War is a life and death issue. And how is it that the abortion issue is the one that can allow a politician to sink or swim? How has that become such a hot button single issue? And the death penalty and war don't seem to be quite as hot.
Well, I think one of the things, as I shared earlier, there was this concerted effort after the civil rights movement to remove some things from moral concerns to issues that you could pick and choose. Jim Watts gave a great analysis about that in the way we ask questions in the media. And I think even the media is going to have some tutoring in how to talk about, you know, faith issues to make sure that we don't get lost in these extremes. That we don't get lost in these extremes. And again, if we're going to talk about death, let's talk about the death of our times. The other thing I would say is the church has a responsibility. Now, I'm a son of the church and a critic of the church, because what the church cannot do is become society, you know, or become just a chaplain of the state. That the, you know, the original.
What do you mean by that?
The original role of the church, you know, after Constantine, he, you know, some folks say he kind of made the church subordinate to Rome, you know, but prophetic faith that Jesus walked in, that the prophets walked in, was outlawed. And it was outlawed because it was a critic of the state rather than a chaplain of the state. It didn't cuddle the state. It discomforted the state and challenged the state.
Let's go back to the phones. Rain is on the line from Raleigh. Did I get that name right?
Yes, that's right.
You have a question for us or a comment?
My question was what you just got to, and when I called 5 minutes ago, you were talking more specifically on abortion. And I was wondering how to broaden the conversation, not just on your program, which you just did, to include other what I consider pro-life issues, like the death penalty and the war in Iraq. And I spoke to the woman that answered the phone, and told her, in my understanding, I was raised Catholic. I now attend a Protestant church, and if we have to put a label on it, I guess you could call it sort of liberal, both the Catholic and the Protestant. And I understand the Catholic Church's position from Rome is that abortion is wrong, the death penalty is wrong, the war in Iraq is wrong. This is what pro-life means. And it seems in this country, like I think Mr. Barber has just said, we get stuck on abortion.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know how we can get unstuck and move on to other, as he said, life and death issues that affect our country.
Thank you for the call, Rain.
Well, it might be helpful for me just to read a couple of sentences from this statement that Anna Eshoo was talking about earlier.
This is from the 55 Democrats.
Catholic Democrats. It's a search for common ground on this. We envision a world, they say, in which every child belongs to a loving family and agree with the Catholic Church about the value of human life and the undesirability of abortion. We do not celebrate its practice. Each of us is committed to reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies and creating an environment with policies that encourage pregnancies to be carried to term. We believe this includes promoting alternatives to abortion, such as adoption, and improving access to children's health care and child care, as well as policies that include paternal and maternal responsibility. I'm sure that's a compromised statement, which people would feel, you know, would agree with one or emphasis or another, but it's an encouraging sign that people are trying, as Reverend Barber has said, trying to look at the broader picture here and do justice to the valuing of life, which our faith does command.
What's the impact of a document like this on Congress as a whole, Congressman? Does that have much impact?
Well, it's just been issued. It's the sort of document that I think has, you know, a lot of work's gone into this, and a lot of people who don't always agree on specific policies have come together here. I would hope that it will be a basis for some coming together on a congressional agenda. It also, I hope, will say to the world that this kind of monopoly of the religious banner, which some have claimed, is not a true claim.
William Barber, do you see any signs of change?
Oh, certainly. I see him. I told a story this morning about being at a Martin Luther King lecture a few weeks ago, and there was this decorated veteran there, and they asked a question about the war, and I almost just said, oh, I know exactly what his position is going to be. And when he opened his mouth, I heard prophetic faith come out. I heard a kind of, you know, having been a warrior, you know, like David in the Bible, but challenging it and challenging the misconception. You know, we are commanded as people of faith to have hope. And I think what can help answer the caller's question, we've got to have these kind of shows, but then we've got to have them with religious leaders, and many times who promulgate these one or two, three issues, and we got to hold them accountable and say, no. Let's talk about moral issues beyond just those three things. The public arena and the media arena can't let folk off the hook. The Bible says, in my tradition, truth sets you free. Half-truth doesn't do that.
William Barber, thank you very much. The Reverend William Barber is president of the North Carolina NAACP, pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro. My thanks to Congressman David Price as well, a Democrat who represents the 4th District. David Price, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
He's also the co-chair of the House Democratic Caucus Faith Working Group. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for calling and for listening. And if you have a comment or want to hear archived editions of the programs, you can go to our website at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.